Welcome to the Plain Dealing Church of Christ Sermon Podcast. I'm Adam Miller, the preacher for the Plain Dealing Church of Christ. This week's sermon began a series of sermons that will go through probably all of May. And it is going to be a series of sermons that revolve around family and the home and our individual identities. And this lesson is a little different. Normally when I've preached on the home or a series of sermons on the home, I haven't had to talk about our personal identity or the fact that there are specific sexes in which God has made man. I'll be honest, this isn't always an easy company, young and old, and family members, that sort of thing, but it's necessary in our culture today, and I hope that it has been helpful for our congregation. Hope it will be helpful for you. Here is lesson one in a series of Building Biblical Homes, a lesson on identity. As we open up our Bibles and as we begin this morning, I'd like to stop and see if anyone younger than 25 can identify this group of people. Anyone in here under 25 know? Bailey, do you know who these kids are? That's sad. This might be the greatest family that's ever existed. And I know for sure that Mr. Winslow, the father, is the best TV dad that was ever on TV. He was a policeman and he would go to war for his children, but he also was funny and he's a good model. But we're going to be talking about, if you don't know who these people are, of course, it is the cast of the TV show Family Matters. And this was the Winslows, along with some comedic relief around the edges there. But they were a family that I grew up watching on TV, and they were a popular sitcom when we were kids. And Urkel became sort of a mania. The Urkel doll, you may remember that, and with all of his little taglines like "Did I do that?" and things like that. But the show was a really good show because it was called Family Matters, and there was sort of a double entendre there because yes, it explored different matters going on in the family, but it also was making the point that in fact family does matter. And so this morning, as we begin this series of sermons and as we begin to go through this series, come on remote. Remind me to everyone to order a new remote. I keep forgetting. But at any rate, we're going to look at Psalm 127 and verse 1 that tells us, "Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain." And so here in this text, we're going to read that God's purpose and God's planning and God being behind us building our homes is absolutely what makes it strong and what makes it survive. In the last 15 to 20 years, and really it's going to go further back than that, but we're seeing the fruit of it in the last 15 to 20 years, there's been an all-out assault on the family. And it's not my intention today to only discuss those things that are wrong, but I want to go back and talk about those things that are right. And we're going to begin with the one whom we serve, and his name is Jesus, as quoted in Matthew 19, verses 4 through 6. Now, to set the stage for this text that's on the screen, before we read it and share it, I've got to let you know the background. And the background is Jesus has just walked into what is supposed to be a trap. Because he's living in a day and age when there's a lot of debate about what constitutes proper family organization, somewhat different than our own. But let's not be in any way naive. The Greek world was alive and well when Jesus lived. And Paul later would go out and spread the gospel into that Greek world. And we're going to see a lot of the same deviations and ideas floating around in their culture as it was in our own. And so in Jesus's day, there were two basic schools of thought among the Jews. There was a rabbi by the name of Hillel and one Shammai on the other side. And these two competing schools of thoughts had different views about what constituted the right to divorce your spouse. And so what they're trying to do is they're trying to get Jesus in a trap and get him to side with one side or the other. There was one rabbi who said, "Well, you know, if your wife cooked a meal you don't like, that's justification to divorce her." And the other school of thought said, "Well, no, the only way you can divorce a spouse is if they have been physically unfaithful to you in that marriage covenant and they have violated that, by means of fornication. And so these two schools of, by the way, we hear the same sort of discussions and arguments populated today in the church. And so they come to Jesus and says, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason? And they're going to trap him. Is he going to side with one side, or is he going to side with the other? And if he sides with this side, we'll get the other side mad at him. If he sides with them, we'll get them mad at him. And by the way, this is what happens a lot, by the way, not just in Jesus' world, but in our own. Have you noticed how often people try to get us to be red or blue, conservative or liberal, this or that? Everyone's got to draw up sides, and so many times nuance is lost in the middle. And so Jesus, when he begins to answer this, he says, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let not man separate. Now, the Jews are going to come on to back this up and say, well, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce? If that's what the case was, why did Moses give the permission to divorce? And Jesus said, well, this wasn't from the beginning, but because of the hardness of your hearts, God tolerated it for a while. But he explains, I'm taking it back to the beginning. And so this morning, as we study together, it's necessary in our culture, it's necessary in our time, it's absolutely necessary in the church that we go back to the beginning and observe some of these basic principles. Now, I want to observe this morning. You know, I put a portion of this quotation on a Facebook post the other day, and I started to put a couple of questions on there that follow it. But you know, it's amazing how many people today would say, I am a Christian, and they would absolutely disagree with what Jesus says here. It's amazing how many people today would say, I'm a Jesus follower, I'm a Christian, but I don't agree with that statement. In fact, I suspect that if I isolated out a couple of quotes from this and I said that, well, I believe that God made males and females and that they should get married if they want to have intimate relations and they should stay married to that one person for life. That people in our culture who say, well, I'm a Christian, but you're being awful judgmental. Well, I'm a Christian, but you know, you are not thinking about all these people who exist on the spectrum, and you're not thinking about these people who are fluid, and you're being awful phobic about your beliefs here. You know, that sounds kind of transphobic to me. You've heard those words, right? Do we understand that in our culture today, in 2023, if Jesus were to walk into America and begin preaching this text, that he would be labeled a hateful, judgmental, phobic individual? Church, if we are going to teach what Jesus taught, we have got to be willing to ignore what the world says about it and stand on what he taught. Now, either we're a Christian or we're not. And it's very important as we begin to talk about building our houses biblically. Remember, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain that build it. Psalm 127 and verse 1. If we're going to build our houses biblically, we need to embrace the teaching of Jesus or ask ourselves, do I really believe that Jesus was the Son of God? Well, I follow Jesus, but I don't agree with everything he said. You know, that's contradictory logic. In fact, Jesus posed the rhetorical question in Luke 6:46 when he said, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do the things I say? Jesus said, I'm not really your Lord if you're not willing to do what I've said. If you're not willing to listen to me, I'm not really in control. And if I'm not really in control, then I'm not really your Lord. And so over the next few weeks, we're going to be talking about the concept and the idea that family matters. And when we're thinking about building biblical houses, we need to make sure that we're doing it with the teaching of Christ. Now, I want to be clear, what Jesus does here is Jesus doesn't introduce some radical new gender ideology. Jesus takes it all the way back to the beginning. In fact, he quotes and pulls from Genesis chapters 1 and 2. And so he goes to chapter 1 where the Bible says, "Then God said, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the heavens, over the livestock, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image, and the image of God he created him, male and female he created them." Now, I've got some things underlined here, and this is very important, because there are some things that our culture does not understand about human beings and does not understand about identity. We hear more today about how people identify. I hear it all the time. I identify as a man, I identify as a woman, I identify as a racial minority, identify this, identify that. And everyone's trying to figure out where they fit in and where they belong because they do not understand this text. Our identity is in those created in the image and likeness of Almighty God. Everything else falls beyond that and below that. And so God says here a few things about man that he created. He said, first of all, man would be made in his image and after his likeness. Sometimes we call this, or this has been known as the Imago Dei, the image of God. And when we think about what it means to be image bearers of God, it means that when God made man unique from every other created thing. Now, here is distinction number one that our world misses. And we've got to understand this if we want to understand the family. Your fellow human beings and you yourself are not just a meat suit. You're not just some other organism walking around that's unlike not unlike a cow or a goat or a tree or something like that. In fact, we miss this so much in our society today. There are many people who say, well, you know, humans are a scourge on the planet. There's too many humans and we're taking resources from the planet and we're hurting the population of the fish or the this or the that. Now, by the way, God put man in the garden to tend and keep it. But notice something intrinsic to our identity here. Not only are we made in the image and likeness of God, but man, let them, that's man, have dominion over the fish, the birds, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing. Guess what? Do you know who's in charge here on planet Earth? Do you know who is most important here on planet Earth? It's human beings. Because they alone are made in the image and likeness of God. Now, it's quite likely that I'm going to offend some people with the next thing I'm about to say, but I assure you it's said with a heart of love with good intentions. Your dogs are not your children. Your dogs are not people. And they do not have the same standing, or your cat, or your goldfish, or your hamster, or your pet cows, or whatever. They don't. You know, I post pictures of my cows. Oh, I love your cows. I love them really a lot when they do one of two things. Bring me a paycheck, or end up at Taco Bell on that beautiful, crunchy taco. Now, someone just got really offended. I told you you were going to be offended. Those cattle exist as a business or as food. They're not my children. My children hold a very special place in my heart. But I understand that God put all of us here on earth and he separated human beings from everything else and he gave us dominion. And that means that man has a responsibility to oversee the works of this world. Now, we shouldn't dump toxic waste everywhere and we should be caretakers of our environment. I'm not saying that, you know, understand what I'm saying here. I'm not saying we're just to ravage and destroy the environment. We're to take care of it. But at the same time, this environment exists for our utilization. And so one of the base things that people don't understand today about other people is that every human being is precious in the eyes of God. Everyone. That's why as Christians we argue for the life of the unborn. Because we believe they're created in the image of God. Someone says, well, I think a woman ought to have a right to do with her body as she wants. I agree. But I also agree there's a body inside of her that has a human being endowed with the image of God, and that human being should be protected and valued as much as every other human being on planet Earth. And by the way, the logic is contradictory. Someone says, I think a woman should do with their body what they want. I think they have full autonomy over their body. No, you don't. If that same woman were to get on meth and use methamphetamines in her 7th, 8th, and 9th month of pregnancy, you would want to prosecute her. You would call Child Protective Services. You would call the Department of Health, right? Why? Because you said, well, they're harming their child. We all know this. That's why if you saw a woman who's 7 or 8, 9 months pregnant and she's chugging beer and smoking cigarettes, you would intuitively frown on her behavior. Why? Well, doesn't she have autonomy over her body? You don't frown on women who do that when they're not pregnant. You know intuitively that she's harming another human being. And even those who are pro-choice would agree with that. And if they're honest, would say, you know what? You're right. And it's because down deep we all understand that other people have intrinsic value because they're created in the image of God. This is the most important part of this morning's sermon. Because this undergirds all of our relationships with one another, our relationship with the planet, our relationship in marriage and in life. And so what happens today is that Satan wants to corrupt this, and he wants to turn us into people who see each other as less than humans. And so that's where hate comes in, and that's where prejudice comes in. And by the way, a lot of other sinful things. I mean, you know, today, when people, for instance, use something like pornography, they are objectifying their fellow humans. And someone says, what's wrong with it? I've had Christians come to me before and say, what about a married couple? If they want to watch something, you know, to whatever, in the privacy of their home, who does it harm? It harms you because you have objectified another human being who is made in the image and likeness of God, and you have made them less than a human being, and you have made them a tool of your personal desire. That's who it harms. You have violated this principle that Jesus said undergirds the home. That we were made in the image of God, and that every human being, male and female, is intrinsically valuable. But he goes on, he says, not only is man made in the image of God, and over again, by the way, in the text, God stresses this so we don't miss it. In the image, likeness, in his own image, in the image of God, he created him. God doesn't want us to miss the point because, friend, this may be the most important fundamental thing you need to know about your neighbor so that you can treat them properly. They are image bearers of God. And when you respect that fact, you will learn to respect and love your neighbor, not because they're a great neighbor, but because they are crafted in the image of the God you love. And that's why the commandments to love your Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, with all your mind, Matthew 22, and to love your neighbors yourself, why they're intrinsically linked. Because when I love my God, I'm going to love my neighbor, because my neighbor's made in the image of my God. You cannot separate those two. And so here Jesus is making this point as he goes back to the beginning. But notice here that God also makes another statement. And I'll be honest, 10 years ago I never thought I would have to make this point in a sermon from a pulpit. I never dreamed this point would have to be made. But the Bible is clear that there is a binary sex. There is male and female that God created. It was not an afterthought and it was not an accident. It was an intentionally formed, just like human beings were intentionally formed in the image of God. Male and female was intentionally crafted by God. Well, what about those who are born intersex? Well, first of all, you're talking about a statistically minute number of human beings, and everyone understands that there was some sort of a deformity or a problem there. No one ever has had a child born with a mutation and they had a celebration party because of that. Oh, well, your child's got a third leg. Your child has a tail. Your child's got an extra eye. No, we don't. Now, I'm not trying to be callous or coarse, but I'm trying to be honest about, we understand that there are deformities that happen in the birthing process because we live in a fallen world. And sometimes those characteristics are not properly displayed in physical birth. By the way, you say, well, Jesus doesn't deal with that. He absolutely does. Turn back to Matthew chapter 19. After Jesus talks about male and female, husband and wife, marriage, and how marriage should not be put asunder by man, he says some men are born eunuchs. Read that text. Do you know what that means? There are some people, and men there's generic, there are some individuals who are born without normal, natural sex characteristics. He says some are made eunuchs by men, and some men become eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of God. Let him who's able to bear it, bear it. Jesus acknowledges that these distinctions are not always present, that there are exceptions to the male and female binary in birth sometimes. But he says, guess what? There's another qualification or classification there. And those are the outliers. And they have their own things we could talk about. But in general, we understand that there is a dichotomy among mammalian species. You learn that in biology, by the way. Yesterday we had a little white dairy cross cow, and I knew she was getting close to calving, and she was off by herself, and I said, she's over there having her calf. And so Melissa and I rode over there, and sure enough, there's a brand new little calf still wet behind the ears laying on the ground. And you know what the question is going to be next? Is it a bull or is it a heifer? I don't know, because it was laying down in the grass. I didn't want to bother. It was brand new. But in the next few days, if everything goes on and the world keeps turning, one day I will identify that new calf so Melissa can give it a boy name or a girl name. And how will I identify that calf? Well, we don't have to go to rocket science school. You don't have to get a master's in biology to understand that, do you? It's either going to be a bull or a heifer. There's no middle ground. We understand that when it comes to our animals. You know, if you get a dog, you don't... Is it a male dog or a female? There's just no other option. It would be ludicrous to go to the vet and say, you know what? I want a Labrador Retriever, and I want it to be, identify as a whatever, one of these 73 genders I can find on Facebook. That's what I want. But it would be silly, right? Again, I'm not trying to be silly, but I'm trying to just make the emphasis that really our whole culture knows that this is true and this is right. But we've pretended, we've been lied to, we've been tricked in some way, so that we've sort of changed our thinking on this for some reason that I can't comprehend. Now, Jesus also alludes to the story of the creation of man and woman in Genesis chapter 2. Because what happens is, in Genesis chapter 1, there's the blanket, God made male and female in His image. And in chapter 2, God probes down on the story of creation of male and female a little bit more, and He gives us a story behind this to explain some of our differences. He says, God caused a deep sleep to fall upon the man, or upon Adam. Now, by the way, it just said in the previous verses 18 and following, that it wasn't good that the man should be alone. God looked for someone to be a companion, but among all that God had created, there was no one suitable to be a helper for the man. And so God caused a deep sleep to fall on the man. And while he slept, he took one of his ribs, literally from his side. And we'll talk more about this in just a moment. The old joke, by the way, man said, how can I get the perfect helper? You know, she'll clean, she'll cook, she'll love me, she'll treat me like a king. God says, that'll cost an arm and a leg. Man says, what can I get for a rib? Men, I normally pick on us. But anyway, ladies, a little bit fun there. Okay, that's going to come off the recording, right? God took from man's side. And the rib that the Lord God had taken from the man, He made into a woman and brought her to the man. And the man said this at last. Listen to that longing. This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. And the man and his wife were both naked, and they were not ashamed. Now there's several things here in this text that we need to point to. Oh, there we go. And so let's look at them very quickly. First of all, notice here that he took one of his ribs. Now, I didn't realize this until I got to studying in the text, but there are some Hebraisms, you know, a rib, the side, etc. We talked about one in Bible class this morning having to do with progeny. But there's a lot of discussion about, was this, you know, in fact, I heard when I was a little kid that all men had one less ribs than women did. And I thought that was true until I studied biology. And I realized we all have the same number of bones if everything's working right. He only took it from Adam, not from every dude, right? But at any rate, this idea of a rib really means from his side. And this is the really important part that we miss. He took something away from Adam. Don't miss that. Adam was no longer whole once the woman was created. And what that means is for a man to be whole. Now, there's all sorts of fanciful ideas about the pre-woman Adam. What was Adam like? You know, there's some that have all these ideas about, you know, he was self-reproducing and all this sort of stuff. I think a bunch of that's fanciful nonsense. But here's something we don't need to miss, is that to make Adam a companion, God removes something from him. And there's an implication here. Men, we are not and cannot be whole without that helper. Now, I want to be clear this morning and throughout this series, I'm going to be presenting the biblical ideal for human relationships. Sometimes those ideals aren't met. We live in a broken and a fallen world. Sometimes people aren't born specifically male or female. Very rare, but occasionally it does happen. Sometimes marriage might be severed by death or by divorce or by betrayal. Sometimes a married couple may not be able to have children. And those things are painful and horrible. But and they illustrate that the ideal is what everyone should be striving for. So again, I'm not saying that a man can't live a single life. Paul was a single person who was a child of God. Jesus never married, and so he was a complete and perfect human being. This does not mean that you have to be married, but what it does mean is that God's ideal is that all men should seek out their completion, seek out this person who makes them whole. Does that make sense? And so the rib he made into a woman and he brought her to the man. Now here's what's so beautiful about this. This is the first wedding ceremony. By the way, they didn't have cake and flowers and all that stuff. But this is the first time that a man and a woman join themselves together. And God is the default officiant there. God gives away the bride. Think about that. Adam is standing here and sees this beautiful creature walking towards him, and God is holding her hand and says, Adam, here is your bride. And in joy, Adam exclaims, this at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Now what he's saying here is, we are the same because she was made out of me. Unlike any other creature that God had created, when Adam saw his wife, he saw someone who was distinct from himself and yet the same as himself. And that's the beauty about our differing sex characteristics, right? Is that I can look at someone who is a woman and I know as a man, that's another human being, but she's not like me. And ladies, when you look at us, you're like, he's almost human and he's sort of like us, right? So there is a difference. So man, I told you, we're not off the hook, right? And so here, Adam gives the imperative. And these are going to be, in the next few weeks, we're going to be talking about marriage. But today we're talking about the distinction and why we need marriage. Notice Adam says there's two things that happen here. Now the old King James Version says, a man shall leave his father and mother and cleave. And you hear the old preacher say, the leave and the cleave, right? Well, that's very important. A lot of young married people never leave their parents' home. Talk to a lot of young married people that have a domineering mother-in-law or a domineering father-in-law or a domineering father, a domineering mother, and they're still trying to control what their baby does. And generally it works out like this. The daddy wants to control his daughter and the mama wants to control his son, but it can go other ways as well. And you've got to be very careful when you marry that you do that. You leave your father and mother and you start a new family. You are not still part of the same family. You have your own family. That is so imperative to marriage. But the second part is that he leaves his father and mother and he holds fast. This word hold fast here is the idea of being cemented together, permanently attached to one another. That's why Jesus said, therefore what God has joined together, let not man put asunder. Because God cements these two together in a union which cannot be broken or should not be broken. By the way, when you concrete or cement or glue two things together and you try to take them back apart, every time you destroy the component parts. Did you realize that? And that's the implication here. Some people say, well, I think I'm just going to leave. I recently spoke to someone who was going through some very difficult times and this person was trying to ask me, you know, I don't see any way we can salvage this. I don't see any way we can stay together. I think I'm just going to have to break it off. And I said, that is not the Christian viewpoint. That is the world. That's your own desires. That's your own frustration. That's your own, you know, you're tired of this situation and you don't see any hope. I said, but that's not the biblical pattern. What God wants you to do is love your spouse sacrificially and you get through this so that you can remain together. That's what God wants. That's what God intends. Now, I'm being clear here this morning. We're not talking about a situation where they were in an abusive situation or alcohol. So understand that's a later lesson. But the ideal is that these two now become one. Guess what? They once were one. God took from man, made the woman, and now he brings them back together. And both are made whole in that union. Now, it's very important in verse 25 that the Bible says the man and the woman were both naked and they were not ashamed. I used to read over that verse, didn't think much about it, but it's so important because we have here divine confirmation and divine sanctification of the marital union. Understand that one flesh is not just some sort of a spiritual union. It implies a physical union, by the way, which one day will ultimately lead to a new flesh from those two children that will be made of the two. In Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 4, the Hebrews writer says that marriage is honorable among all and the bed undefiled. But fornicators and adulterers God will judge. And we read here in the book of Genesis chapter 2 that when man and woman are brought together that there is no shame in their union. I understand these subjects in our world today are so difficult to talk about. And so, trust me, there's things I'd rather preach about prayer this morning. You don't think that with my parents in the room? I understand the uncomfortable nature of this in our society and how we don't want to talk about these subjects. But we should never be ashamed to talk about biblical human sexuality. It is sanctioned by God and there is no shame there. And one of the problems is because we've been afraid to talk about what's right and only condemn those things that are wrong, a lot of people walk away from the church with the idea that there's only negative involved with attraction and pleasure. And the answer is that is wrong. God created these people to be together and to enjoy their lives together. That is the ideal. And we need to understand this is sanctioned by God, and it is something that should be taught in the home and in the church. Now, after we've passed through creation, let's move forward. And someone might say this morning, well, Adam, why does it matter? Why are we talking about these things as we wrap this lesson up? It's sort of uncomfortable. I get it. We all understand. You don't need to tell anybody. No, we do. And here's why it matters. A report came out just last month. In fact, just a week ago, on April the 27th of 2023, the CDC did a report from data that it gathered in 2021 that shows that today, 1 in 4 high school students identify as LGBTQ. That's why it matters. That means in our local high school, all things being even, that if you took a class of 40 kids, 10 of those kids would have said, I am not normal sexual. I don't fit the biblical model that the preacher just talked about this morning. I'm something different. And in fact, when you look at the numbers, what we're going to see is it went from 11% to 26% from 2015 to 2021. Won't you read that again? In 6 years, the numbers of kids saying that went from 11 to 26. Now, I want you to know that those who are advocates for the LGBTQ, they are ecstatic at these numbers. And what they are saying is they are saying, well, all these kids were having to hide and be ashamed of their identity, but now that we've opened it up, and by the way, it's on every commercial, it's on every TV show. I saw a children's show the other day where some little kids were watching two cartoon T-Rexes, and they were standing over a little nest, and it looked like eggs, and one of the TV characters said, those aren't eggs, they're rocks. And the other one said, the two daddy T-Rexes want to have babies just like all the other T-Rexes. Families. This is a show for little kids. And they're trying to put... Now, by the way, anyone who's ever seen Jurassic Park, anyone who ever knows anything about reproduction, that's nonsense. It's crazy. But they're trying to force this agenda and they want to drive the number up from 26% even further. Make no mistake. It is not about people finding themselves. It's about pushing this agenda because it's an anti-God agenda. Because what we see is when we embrace our created sex and when we embrace our created relationship to love one another sacrificially in marriage, we are embracing the idea that there's a relationship between Christ and the church. More on this next week, by the way. And what we are doing is we are mirroring the relationship of God with His people. It was created for a purpose that's much more than about your pleasure or what you want. In marriage, we glorify God. And we've got to get back to understanding that. Why does it matter? Adam, why do we talk about these things? They're embarrassing for me. And so, remote control. I'm going to remember after today. On June the 10th of 2022, a New York Times, by the way, really conservative bastion, right? Everybody says, oh, well, you're just pulling conservative points. No, the New York Times article cites data that says the number of people who identify as transgender has doubled in recent years. Now, I want to read a section from the book Irreversible Damage. If you have daughters, you need to read this book. If you have granddaughters, you need to read this book. Period. End of story. Abigail Schreier says, gender dysphoria, formerly known as gender identity disorder, is characterized by a severe and persistent discomfort in one's biological sex. It typically begins in early childhood, ages 2 to 4, though it may grow more severe in adolescence. But in most cases, listen to this, in most cases, nearly 70% or more, childhood gender dysphoria resolves on its own. Historically, it afflicted a tiny sliver of the population, roughly 0.01%, and almost exclusively boys. Listen to this. Before 2012, in fact, there was no scientific literature on girls ages 11 to 21 ever having developed gender dysphoria at all. In the last decade, that has changed, and dramatically. The Western world has seen a sudden surge of adolescents claiming to have gender dysphoria and self-identifying as transgender. For the first time in medical history, natal girls are not only present among those who so identifying, they constitute the majority. Now I want you to know, if you didn't follow all of that, here's what she says. That traditionally speaking, those who had gender identity disorder, classically called, would constitute somewhere around 0.01% of the populace, and they were all in their adolescence. All of them were boys thinking they were girls. There were no documented cases and no literature of little girls thinking they were boys. None. Until 2012. Later in the book, she says that today, as of writing of this book, which is a few years old now, there had been a 4,440-something% increase in the rate of girls identifying as boys. Now, either there's something in the water, or there's something in the culture. You say, why does it matter? Well, here's why it matters. Because our little girls are being told that they can block their hormones. And if they want to be a girl later, they can just start back up and everything will be fine. That is a lie. It's a medical lie. They're being told they can take testosterone for a short period of time. And if they decide to change later, just quit taking the testosterone and everything will be okay. That's a lie. Because in 3 to 6 months, young girls taking testosterone will start to grow facial hair. And when they quit taking that testosterone, that 5 o'clock shadow will remain with them for the rest of their lives. In 4 to 6 weeks after taking testosterone, their voice will lower more than an octave. And that lowering voice will remain with them after those 4 to 6 weeks for the rest of their lives. Beyond that, more terrible and heinous effects are that in just a few short months, they will be rendered sterile and will never be able to reproduce or bear children of their own. And we are seeing a plethora of these transitioners coming out of the woodwork today saying, why did my parents let this happen? Why did they do this to me? Why did the doctor do this to me? You say, why are you talking about this on Sunday morning? Because Jesus said God made them male and female, and some of you parents may be confronted with this in your home or in some of your friends' home or some of your family's home, and you're going to have to say, what do I do? How do I address it? Well, typically we just try to be nice. There is no Bible verse that says be nice. There is one that says be kind. But we also have a mandate to speak the truth. And before someone we love or know harms their children in an irreparable way, we should have the courage of conviction to say this is not right. Now, here's how it normally happens. They'll come to a parent and they'll say, well, your child identifies as a member of the opposite sex and says they're also suicidal, and so here's your choice. You can have a dead son or a living daughter. What do you think parents are going to do? Many of them, out of fear, will go along because the expert is supposed to know the truth. The doctor is supposed to know what's right. And what ends up happening is there are the same rates of self-harm among those who transition as those who do not. The answer is, it is not a cure for their problems. It only makes their problems worse. I don't like talking about this from the pulpit. I don't like talking about this in mixed company. I don't like doing it. But it is necessary because it is absolutely from the devil. This last week, PragerU, if you don't follow them, they're an amazing follow. They put up a quote from Deuteronomy 22 and verse 5, which says, "A woman shall not wear man's clothing, nor shall a man put on a woman's clothing. For whoever does these things is an abomination to the Lord your God." Now, what I found so interesting was the comments section of this verse. And when you look at the comments, you have some like this: "It's a good thing we no longer follow the outdated Old Testament laws, or else you'd have me wearing knee-length skirts. It's all about attitude. Great Old Testament quote. Good news is, if you're a Christian, you're not living under the law and you're not bound by this. I live under the new covenant." On and on it goes. "Oops, I better return my Levi's that I've been wearing since the 70s. That's between Jesus and the person. It's none of my business to judge them. My job is to love my neighbor as Jesus loves me." I want you to notice the commonality in all these quotes that I put on the screen. They all claim to be Christians. And they all say it doesn't matter how men and women dress. Now, I want to clean up a few things about this before we move on. Some of them mentioned blue jeans. And there's a mindset that existed back in the mid-1900s that it was a sin for women to wear pants. Well, I'm going to go ahead and tell you, I've never bought my pants in the women's section of the store. And there are some bedazzled, bejeweled britches that I will never put on because they are clearly women's. And if I did, it would, you know, there won't be no skinny jeans on this guy, okay? And you need to understand that what Deuteronomy is talking about is not that some clothes are okay for men and some clothes are okay for women. He's talking about men should not represent themselves in such a way that others would see them and think that's a woman or women. By the way, if a woman has on blue jeans, a girl's cut blue jeans and girl's cut shirt, you don't think, oh, there's a dude, right? You think there's a woman who happens to be wearing jeans. It's so silly how people try to finagle around and twist what God clearly says. What he's saying is we should not do anything to pervert our natural presentation of gender. But we're so confused about it in our culture today. I want to spend just a few minutes, and I promise this lesson will be yours. Gender as a concept is new to culture. It's less than 100 years old. Did you know that? In fact, 100 years ago, if someone was to mention gender, they more than likely would be talking about language. Have you ever studied foreign languages? Spanish, for instance, has gendered word, hermano and hermana, la hermana, right? El hermano. Those are gendered languages. And gender classically referred to the words you use, and it was based on the sex of the individual. And so in Spanish, if we're talking about a male, every time we put a el hermano. And if we're talking about a female, it's la abuela with an A on the end, right? That's all the Spanish I remember from high school. But that's what gender is all about. You're going to find it in the Greek language. You're going to find it in the classical, the Romance languages. You're going to see that gender has always tied to biological sex. But we had a character by the name of John Money. And I want to encourage everyone in here, if you're brave, to write that name down and read his Wikipedia page and read stories about this human monster. He founded the first gender clinic in America at Johns Hopkins University. But John Money was a Kiwi, he was a New Zealander, who invented the words sexual orientation, and he also invented the concept that gender was a social construct. Okay? One quick word about sexual orientation. We have been brainwashed in our culture today to say, well, they are what? Gay, or they are lesbian. But biblically speaking, when someone does those things or lives, that's not their identity. Those are behaviors they exhibit that can be changed. Now, isn't it interesting in our world that you have someone like Ann Hesch, very well known, who was previously married to Ellen DeGeneres, everyone saw, but now she's married to a man. And what that threw the whole "we're born this way" thing in the grinder. Because when I was a kid, we were being force-fed, well, people are born that way and you can't change it. And then when people started changing, all of a sudden people said, well, we got to, oh, well, they're bi. Everyone's squirming in the pews this morning. No one more than me, I promise, right? This is important because it's on every TV show, commercial, and YouTube video you're going to see. Those are not biblical constructs. Biblically, when we talk about behavior that's intimate, we're talking about behavior and not orientation. John Money in the 1900s created the concept of orientation and saying, well, that's just how people are. No, that's not how people are. People can change. People can change their behavior. Now, beyond Money's view of that, one of the things he did, which was just diabolical and evil, he found a set of young boys who were twins. And one of these young boys had a tragic accident during his circumcision, and the parents didn't know what to do, and they found out about this man, John Money. And John Money had the idea that gender was a social construct, and so he had his perfect little lab rats. And he told the parents, he said, we're going to do surgery on the little boy who'd been injured. We're going to make him physically a girl. And then you're going to raise him as a girl, and you'll never tell him he's a boy. Never. You can't ever hint. You always tell him he's a girl. And the other little boy, you're going to raise him like a boy. And throughout the years, the parents, because they were so desperate, followed the advice. And the problem was the young boy who they were raising as a young girl and changed his name to a girl's name still wanted to use the bathroom standing up and still wanted to play with trucks and not dolls and was still very aggressive and wanted to be out playing baseball and building things with the boys. To compound that, Mr. Money was molesting the boys when they'd come in for office visits. And both of these twins were dead before they were 40 years old, one by suicide, the other by drug overdose. And John Money is the one expert that has laid the groundwork for all of our gender theory in America. Every gender clinic, everything we know about it is based on his research, which was completely falsified. He was an absolute monster, and every American needs to know this. Go read. I'm not making this up. He was a monster. And he lied about, he told everybody, oh, the little boy we raised, she's perfectly happy and she's the one. And all this was put into research. And people today have learned this. And the doctors now that are doing this to our children, they learned from his research, which was completely fabricated and falsified. I want to point you to John 8 and verse 44, where Jesus says that the devil was the father of lies. And what Satan has done in our culture is he has lied to us and told us that there are more than two genders and that gender and sex are not in any way connected and that we can be whatever we want to be and how we feel is how things are. And if you say that, you hate people. That's the kicker. In fact, by putting this on the internet, you know, we may be blocked or our channel may be taken down or something like that because we're phobic and we hate people and we're bringing violence. I have the utmost compassion for those two young boys. And I have the utmost compassion for every child who is confused or led astray and lied to by the devil and ends up destroying their bodies and destroying their lives and going down a pathway that will never lead to happiness and satisfaction and fulfillment. We can try and counterfeit God's plan, but it will never pass as proper currency. In the book of 2 Corinthians chapter 11, verses 3 and 4, Paul says, and he's worried about Christians, he says, but I am afraid that as the serpent deceived Eve by his cunning, your thoughts will be led astray from a sincere and pure devotion to Christ. He goes on down to say later in that same chapter in verses 13 through 15, and this is so important for us to remember, church. He says, for such men are false apostles, deceitful workmen, disguising themselves as apostles of Christ. And no wonder, for even Satan disguises himself as an angel of light. So it is no surprise if his servants also disguise themselves as servants of righteousness. Their end will correspond to their deeds. And what Paul says is those who support Satan and those who support wickedness never come out and say, we're doing terrible things to people and we're bringing harm. They're saying, no, oh, we're letting people find their authentic self and love is love and we want everyone to be happy and you're just a hater. You're the person over there who's bringing the hate. And Paul says their ends will correspond to their deeds. People who hurt human lives are wicked. And they can polish it up and put a rainbow stole on and say they're a minister of the gospel, but they are liars and they're servants of the devil if they corrupt what Lord Jesus said about gender and sex. That's as plain as I can say it. We need to realize there's nothing to be confused about. We all know the answer. Every one of us knows. But we are being cowed by fear so many times to compromise our convictions.